You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything.
Down with the DC talk.
Can I give you guys a little life story before we get going here?
Is the life story a chomper update?
I have a chomper update, but that's not the life story.
Because I talked to two or three people in the courtyard Sunday that were waiting for a chomper.
That
update.
Were like, "What's
who
wrong?"
Who hadn't heard because we released last week's episode a little late.
Oh,
and so they're listening to that today. Hopefully, it came out Monday. They're getting a chomper update, but we got a second. Chomper
yes.
update.
Well, let me just give you the chomper story. Update, and then I'll tell you the story. Okay. So, chomper update just went about an hour ago. My mouth is
on fire,
horribly. Now, it's not like burning fire, but it is very hurt. It's like you know, like when you used to get in bar fights. It's like those days.
Oh, dude, yeah, that's yeah, such a good throwback.
Just totally
punch you right in the chompers.
Totally,
they are still temporary, but I told the dentist. Please make them not look like I'm a freak because he made them too short last time and people were like, what's wrong with you? And I was saying my S is weird and Janet across the hall thought I was chewing tobacco.
And you I'm know, like, you could pick up a little bit on the S is weird on the podcast last week. I didn't want to say it.
Yeah, I could hear it.
You
can
hear
it
in the recording.
And so I was just like, please, can you just spend a little more time? And to his credit, I was his masterpiece today. My teeth are a touch from the master's hand.
You were clay in the potter's hands today, baby.
He was like, more resin. Yes, let's cure that. More resin. Drawing little lines, polishing it.
With the blue light.
These are the nicest temporaries anybody has ever had.
Your dentist will never receive a second complaint as long as he has anything to say about
it. Are you erasing the Yelp review right now?
Oh, gosh. Anyway, so that's the chomper update.
More to come.
Yeah, more to come.
Thanks for bringing us along.
We're still
the chomper
midway.
Journey.
The other thing I just want to tell you, I'm just very proud of that. I don't get a lot of opportunities to be the stereotypical man in our household.
Oh yeah,
I tend to be the one who cries during movies. There's only a few things. I mean, I do barbecue. I'm like the barbecue guy.
Such a good. Barbecue.
I'm imagining
I still
Olivia
remember that.
Kind of coming over and like. Dad, can you pull it together a little bit? Like she's trying to call you to task. I can see that.
And then probably my most shameful that I'll just share with you guys and be vulnerable is I don't typically kill the spiders in our house.
Oh, we've talked about that.
Katie will do that.
Didn't you have a spider crawl out of like a shaving
Katie
can?
Katie kill the spiders?
Yeah, she doesn't care. She just goes over and whacks it with a slipper or something.
You know, the more times that I hear you talk about you and Katie... I grow in respect for Katie over and over again.
She's pretty incredible.
She is. It sounds like.
However, there is a line and we found it.
Oh, man.
So our sink kept clogging our kitchen sink.
Yeah.
And the solution was like usually a team effort of us going to, it's a two-sided sink.
Okay.
So one person has to put their hands in the nasty water. The other person has to plunge.
Oh.
And then we unclog the thing. And this time, it was not unclogging. And I wasn't even there for dinner that night. But she's like, this is a boy job, and you need to fix it. And
good
I'm like,
her.
Oh, my God.
Throwing the gauntlet.
So I go in there. I'm like, I've never plunged anything so hard in my life. I'm getting, like, splashback of this, like, spaghetti dishwater. And nothing. And I look under the sink like I have any idea what's under there.
Yeah. And you just assume something's going to be on fire. And you're like, oh, I should fix that.
So we had gotten to a point where I think I was starting to think that there was something wrong with the garbage disposal. And maybe that was causing the clogs. Or it might be that our 9-year-old has had to face some consequences recently of not taking her dish to the sink. So now when she doesn't take her dish to the sink, she has to do the dishes. But when a 9-year-old does dishes, they have no regard for putting stuff down the wrong side of the sink.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's one of those two, but the garbage disposal was having a hard time. And I tried to run the garbage disposal because it would suck the water out of one side of the sink so I could try to put in like Drano.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this was like not your mama's Drano. This was...
It kind of comes in its own plastic bag.
Yes.
Drano.
Yeah, yes. And they're like, please put on goggles and
they're like,
and
this
gloves.
May explode, so be careful. And they're like, what in the world?
So
that
I was
stuff
like,
is actually bad enough. Like, if you call a plumber to come fix it after you've poured that kind of solvent down, they'll refuse.
Oh, wow.
It's because the pipes are going to... As long as that stuff is in the pipes, it's a hazard to work on.
Interesting you say so that, because
you
were
on your own.
I did call a plumber.
Okay.
Ooh.
And he quoted me like a 48 hours would come, and I'm sure he would have charged me $1 million. Yeah. And Katie's like, no, this will not stand.
This isn't it.
You need to deal with this problem. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I had like this thing on Saturday where I've had to play like a show, and I came back. On the way home, I bought a garbage disposal, did a little research, went to a Lowe's, found it, and I replaced that garbage disposal, y'all.
Okay.
I opened up the P-trap or whatever that thing is.
Yeah, there you go.
The little U was completely impacted with the nastiest, like, I don't know why or when they had it. I wasn't there for it, but imitation crab meat. And it had congealed with the other stuff.
You're slowly ruining sushi for me.
So I went out, knocked it against the, you know, like the thing. Bricks a little bit,
loosened
that up, connected that back up, put together the garbage disposal, and now it's a quieter model. I bought the very best.
Boom. Heck only the best for the family.
Only the best garbage
2
disposal.
Horsepower.
One. That means there is like
a power
horse
of one horse is grinding. Yeah.
2/10 of a horse grinding your goo.
And if you've ever watched a horse kill a rat or anything on a farm, you know there's some power.
Yeah. And the height of our tension was I was under the sink. I don't know if either of you have ever done this, but garbage disposals are quite heavy. And the way that you twist them onto the thing, it's a thing. And I'm like laying under there and I'm trying to get it on. This is the home stretch. We're there. I've already installed the seal, all the stuff.
I was going to ask about the seal. Make sure you put the seal.
Yeah, plumber's putty.
I've done that wrong once. I had to undo it all to add the seal.
And as we're the final thing, and I'm having a hard time, she goes, should we call somebody? And I literally stopped and I looked at her like she had just stabbed me in the heart. And I was like,
you were filling with pride.
Yeah,
I'm like, you're one twist away.
I'm about to do this. And she's like,
she deflated the whole thing.
He's not going to get it. This artist, non-spider killer, is just not going to get this. And every time she runs,
like, non-spider killer.
I run into the kitchen every time she runs, and I'm like, how does that feel? How's that feel? You running that?
Oh, I could. Can I hear it? Oh, it's the quiet mom. I can barely hear it. Interesting.
And I'm getting my girls to come in the kitchen. They're like, Dad, we don't care about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, but someday cares? They will, and I'll remember.
That is awesome. I've had to replace the garbage disposal in every single house I've ever lived in except this one.
Man, I should have called you. You could have been my buddy.
I'm talking about apartments we've been in where that one I called people. But it's like every time we move, there's something wrong with the disposal. I could have, we could have navigated that together.
Kevin, I told you this yesterday, but I'll say it again publicly, that this was one of your more profound, thought-provoking messages. I had to just sit with it for a while. Like, I was like, man, I don't even want to lead these two songs at the end because I need to think about what just happened.
And I do think this Job series as a whole has been one of the more profoundly good sermons here we've done in a while.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
It took you a couple of years, but you started.
found my swing. No, it has Sunday and but the series in general, it's been fun to watch it resonate with the body, and I haven't figured that out. Other than I think again we don't often ask these hard, deep questions about suffering and. And both I think what we've been trying to do, and this is far more than just me, is many of the conversations we have as we play in the worship set and series and all that sort of stuff helps develop the thinking. But just that we've been trying to hold together the personal experience of suffering while still asking the big kind of cosmic questions of where this comes from. And so I think holding that tension of these questions aren't just good to ask, like they're personal. And they stem from stories. And so, I mean, that's what's been so humbling for me is not just what I've been learning along the way, but how many people I talk to who then share their like their story of like, this is what I've been going through. That's been like really profoundly humbling, that just people are, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of suffering. And so I'm grateful that that we've been able to ask these questions and process these, but it's definitely opened up some good thinking.
And I'm grateful that CPC, at least for me, seems like a place where you can bring that brokenness. Like you don't have to pretend like everything's perfect in order to come in.
Yeah.
Come into church, which I think is a really beautiful thing. I'm curious, just as before we get started, like this message is maybe the closest we've gotten and maybe the closest we will get to an answer to the problem of suffering.
Yeah.
Even though it's not quite a black and white answer. Yeah. It's the closest we get. And it really honestly kind of reframed some stuff for me when I think about this problem. And I said, we're going to talk about this, but I'm curious, like, before this, before you went into this Job series and started studying for yourself, did you see it like this? Are you just, is this a refresher for you? Or is this kind of, if some of this kind of like expanding your own view on suffering?
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt it's expanding my own view. I don't think I had, like even the discussion around the retribution principle, like I think in theory, I would have been able to, I wouldn't have had the language for it, but I would have articulated something like, yeah, God isn't vengeful. He's not going to always be back at me or be angry at me. But again, so many of the conversations, even before we hit record that we were having, were about it's that principle is so deep into our bones. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's been enlightening to just pull the curtain back, pull the different layers back to see a little further, like, oh man, yeah, on paper, I wouldn't say I believed in the retribution principle, but it's there. Like in practice, it's way, way deeper than that.
Yeah.
And so that's been for sure one of the things. And then honestly, this past Sunday, the topic of God's justice as part of his character, but not about the character of creation, that's been really new for me. Yeah. To really sit with how that differentiation, again, it's about as close, I think, as an answer as we get. It helps me at least understand where suffering comes from and then to see, you know, where that leads into, and we'll get into it. But that topic of grace and how grace really is the thing that sustains creation, like it's holding back that chaos. That's been new and fresh.
Which I'm going to ask you to unpack that a little bit in a bit. But before we go there, so this is the section where God speaks.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think about all these people that, you know, all of us, including me, like when you're in that moment where you kind of cry out to God, all you really want, all you want is for God to speak.
Yeah.
And in this passage, you know, God speaks.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, as you guys read this, like, does his response catch you off guard? Is it a response that you would expect from God? Like what were your kind of first impressions when you, and maybe you read this a long time ago, but when I'm reading through, you know, you didn't read God's whole response on Sunday, but secretly as you were talking just for a minute, I just kind of skimmed through and it's long and it's like,
boom, boom,
like the
boom,
way that boom. The consistency of how he basically says a lot of almost like sarcastic comments, like, you must have seen that, right?
Yeah.
You must have been there when blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It's like, you see why at the end of that Job was like, okay, I'm sorry.
I put my hand over my mouth.
Totally.
What do you guys think? Does it catch you off guard at all?
I read Job sort of recently, like late last year. I don't remember thinking too much of it. I think it made sense to me. It's like if I heard an ant on the ground yapping at me, complaining about this or that, or trying to understand things it can't possibly comprehend, that's exactly how I'd respond. It's like, do you hear something?
Yeah, yeah.
Who? Where were you when all of this happened?
Do you know how to drive a car, ant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know how to balance a checkbook?
Do you understand what stars are?
Yeah. Yeah, but it is like, because it's totally like when you zoom out and see that, it's like, of course, that's the response. But it does strike me, like when you think about all that Job had lost and that, like, the immense grief he's in.
Yeah.
that when God speaks, this is where he goes first, yeah. You know, is kind of startling. And I don't know what, like, I don't know what to do with it other than maybe view it as God at least taking Job seriously enough to respond that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I was a basketball coach, I used to tell my players, don't be mad if I'm hard on you. Be mad when I stop talking to you. Because then I've stopped caring. You know what I mean? Like, that was the point where I was like, I don't care what you do because you're not going to play or whatever. But when I was hard on him or I'd come down hard on him, it was like, that's actually a sign that I still want you to work hard or whatnot. And it's different with Job, but there's a sense of that where it's like, God at least took Job seriously enough to respond. And then to respond with that level of intensity maybe makes sense to your point, Nico, on what that kind of looks like.
Yeah. I'm just reminded about, like, when you read this story, your view of who you think God is really does make a difference with how you process the story, I think. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, that rant that God goes on, if you read that through the lens of God being an angry, vindictive, mean monster, which kind of is an underlying way that people view God a lot, then you're going to read that so much different than if you believe God's end goal is to redeem humanity. And that he is, like you said, kind of a strategist for the redemption. So I think, like our view of God is so important. But you said this phrase and you did spend kind of the whole message unpacking it. But I'm just wondering if you can help us understand a little bit more.
Yeah.
This idea that the world doesn't operate on justice. It operates on wisdom. And so maybe if you could really maybe unpack those two, like, how do we think the world operates on justice? Which I know we've talked about a lot, but just rehash it for us.
It gets back to, again, the retribution principle and the idea that we assume it'd be interesting to explore more where it comes from.
Well, I think I had a thought about that as we were talking about this. I think it comes from how we would view the world if we were God, or run the world, or how we'd like to think we run the world.
No doubt.
Is on a principle of justice.
And I think what's complicated, right, is that is in some ways part of how God, what God asks of us is to extend justice, right, to the world. So to heal that is unjust.
Then it seems so counterintuitive for it not to run that way to begin with.
It's like and so it feels like that's what we're supposed to be doing, but it's actually because the world doesn't run on that we need to be agents of that. And so it's almost in some ways like part of God giving us that task is another, you know, semblance of grace in which we could bring order to the disorder, because it isn't created that way. And now I think it's also important that when we talk about the world doesn't operate on justice, that we also make the really important point that it doesn't run on injustice or injustice. It isn't that injustice is how God wants the world to operate per se. It just is, right? Like, that's what's been so hard and such a tension to live in. It's simply we have imported this idea that justice is how everything should operate. And so therefore, when injustice happens, we blame God for that. But that's the heartbeat. And what, again, where it really stuck out to me was, again, and I know we'll get to the conversation around tohu vavohu, but when it's God creates the world, creates the heavens and the earth, and then the earth has chaos.
I had never once considered that.
Isn't that interesting? Like, the order of that's really important. Like, God creates, and chaos, disorder, I feel like I'm more comfortable with than chaos for whatever reason. But it's created with disorder. Yeah. You know, like, it's created of just raw, unfiltered creation. And so it just is there. And that is, that then necessitates, again, the complexity that comes from that necessitates the wisdom of God to understand how to operate within that. Because I think a rigid, maybe another angle at the rigid justice running the world is I think if that was imposed onto creation, it wouldn't, I mean, creativity can't run off rigidity in some ways, right? Like, creativity, even that sense of beauty and all these things, like, it you need less rigidity in order to kind of expand into those avenues, you know? And so
if the world was like, if we were perfect.
Yeah.
The world wouldn't really need justice, right? Like, yeah. if sin yeah. had never entered the world, justice would be unnecessary.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
but you would still, and here's the interesting part, with the disorder, you know, preceding sin, you would still have image bearers creating and building.
Yeah.
You know, that is not just, the task of the human is not just
counteract
to
sin.
Work to counteract sin. It's to also just take creation yeah. And be cultivate creative. It. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's new creation. That's why I believe in eternity, we'll have jobs, we'll do things, we'll build things, we'll create things. It just won't have the impact of sin.
Which is a beautiful side note, like what you create, what you bring into this world.
Yes.
Is so important.
Mm-hmm. And carries on into eternity.
It has, yeah. It's like...
It's the Russell Crowe line, like right?
When I write a
what
song.
What we do in this life echoes in eternity. Like, Russell Crowe was right. Mm-hmm. There's a part, at least there he was.
Well, his writers were right.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. That's fair. Yeah, props to the writers.
But. So, like, you use the illustration about gravity.
Dude, I yeah. loved that.
And that was, I took that from John Walton. That was in that commentary. I've been reading along with it. But yeah, we never blame gravity for being unjust or just.
You can't. Gravity in many ways runs the entire universe on every single scale, and you can't claim that it's good or bad.
Yeah, it just is. And I think it's a helpful way to think through, again, God as the creator. Like, there are things that God has created that help the world to function that just are.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of this, I'm circling back, and I thought I wanted to mention a moment ago, too, that I think relates. You know, in the creation story, when God over and over says it's good, it's good, it's good, we have tended to interpret Genesis 1 and 2 as meaning creation was perfect, meaning without flaw. And I think that's where this goes sideways. The good there, I think, might be a better interpreted as functional or harmonious, like it works together. But when we use, in the Western world, when in an over-rationalized world, when we use the word perfection, we think of it as without flaw. But I don't think that's actually what the Hebrew or the biblical writers, you know, kind of intuit. It's similar to when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. He doesn't actually mean like without flaw. The word there is telos. It's be mature would actually be a bit of a better translation. Be mature as your heavenly Father is mature. It carries a nuance of perfection, but I think this is where we run into issues with this idea of justice. It's because if the world before sin was, quote, perfect, which I'm not saying it was, like, flawed, I'm not saying that, but it's more of that sense of the garden was carved out to create a functional space for the human project to flourish. So it isn't necessarily like Behemoth and Leviathan were there. Mm-hmm. You're going to bump up against some of the disorder. But we import that as, again, some sort of intrusion.
Yeah.
And that first step, that first step is to for us to kind of grasp God created and there was still disorder. That was, in some ways, the whole creative thing is light and dark, land and sea, night and day. Like, that's God giving enough order to the garden so that we could flourish. And what we tend to forget, or that, you know, is maybe new for us, is there are uninhabited parts that we don't know about in creation where Behemoth and Leviathan are, where there is still that disorder. And if you start there, then all of a sudden we can grasp this idea that chaos can be apart from the concept or the result of sin.
Yeah.
But no doubt chaos and sin inflict a massive amount of disorder and pain too.
Sin likely and does like exacerbate chaos.
Without question.
Disorder.
Yeah, without question. But not always, and that's the tension.
Yeah.
God looked at his creation and said, it is good, not it is perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Except yeah. for what did he say when he created man?
It is very good.
Very good.
Very, very good.
Yeah.
Which I resonate with. You know,
I might contend with him on that.
Is that what you told your dentist today? These veneers are
very,
very
good.
Very good.
This was your my last visit was not your best work.
Yeah. That was tohu vavohu all over the dentist office. But this has been very good.
I compare your last
name
to Leviathan.
Yeah, can you name your old veneers Behemoth and Leviathan?
Oh, man.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, one of the things that I was processing through that you didn't really inherently say, but I just was thinking in terms of how we have our view of what we think God should do.
Yeah.
whether we name that or not, I think seldomly we know that's not really acceptable. But I think,
or whether we know what it is or not, sometimes it just operates.
Yeah, we just think God should do things a certain way, and you even hear that when people talk about politics. You know, I laugh when people like talk about, you know, someone that they think is not doing a good job as if they would do it better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And maybe there are people that would do it better, but like, just it's an intense amount of pride, like, to be able to say, I know how God should be operating the universe. And then I started thinking about my own pride. I would love to blame all the prideful people outside of myself, but the reality is I do that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of mentioned this. I'm not sure these are actually your words, but something like the idea of how we think the world operates is typically a self-serving way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And Nico, you remembered one of your favorite quotes from the sermon. We think, what was it again?
We think the world was designed for our comfort, but it's not.
Yeah.
Ouchie.
Ouchie indeed.
Ouchie. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
That hits hard in the Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And if we don't think it was designed for that, we certainly think we can make it that way.
Yeah.
Right. And we can create it.
Even if it wasn't designed that way, we can bend it to that purpose.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Which again, I think it just relocates, like, if we can come to a place of acceptance of that concept, I think it just relocates suffering, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's like, oh, this is just, again, a part of what it means to be human, is you will go through these seasons. It doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it good.
It doesn't mean that something went wrong.
Yeah. It just means it is. And I think we have to get to that place of accepting, like, it wasn't designed to protect us. It wasn't designed to keep us comfortable. It's just, you know, it's just the created world.
The mind bending part for me, this idea that God sort of holds back the chaos or the tohu vavohu, and he creates carves out a space, you know, using the Garden of Eden as an example, that can be cultivated where humans can exist. And you gave this quote, that I'm gonna ask you to just kind of unpack it little bit, because the ramifications of this, like I said, it's kind of the closest we get to an answer of the problem of suffering from God. Start with this idea that he permits a level of disorder to accommodate the continued existence of sinful humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it really gets, again, as you mentioned, the tohu vavohu part is important to understand, that that's existing kind of there. And so when you see the garden as then that carved out space, where God seems to be, you know, pushing the bounds of that where we can exist or flourish, is God then allows or creates that space for us to exist, but recognizes, since Adam and Eve, Genesis 3, when we encounter sin, that we often partner with Behemoth and Leviathan, or the tohu vavohu. And so we then, within that carved out space, create disorder and chaos. And so if it runs off justice, the answer would be, and you actually kind of see this in the story, right, with Noah's Ark, where God looks at the created order and says, this is absolutely terrible. Like, it grieves him so much, he's like, I want to start over. And so the flood comes and he wipes out humanity, but he leaves, you know, Noah and his family to restart the story.
Yeah.
And then I think what's so beautiful, right, is it that helps me understand when God says, I place the rainbow in the air, I'll never do that again, is that grieved him. Like, you can sense the grief in there. And so you almost get the sense that he recognizes, I'm going to have to create room for sinful humanity to exist.
Wow.
And so therefore he permits, accommodates some modicum of injustice. Mm. Like, it has to exist in order for us to still survive, which then now we can understand or begin to look at this issue of suffering through the lens of God's grace. Which completely flips the narrative.
Completely.
Yeah, it's not God punishing. It's not God inflicting. It's God is actually, like, what could have happened if God weren't in the picture? How bad could it have got? Which is, again, not the way you would necessarily pastorally counsel someone, but it does, in the broader sense, help us to understand God is more gracious than we realize, because none of us could stand if it was run on the justice that we desire.
How well would it go if somebody came to you grieving and you were like, yeah, but we deserve way worse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not the aim. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So going back to that quote, Walton says, suffering is inevitable in a world where order has not been finally and fully established. And again, that is where the story's going. In New Creation Eternity, order will be finally and fully established. That's the vision that the prophets give, right? Where death is no more, where the lion lays down with the lamb, where the weapons are beaten to plowshares. Like, all that is language of a fully ordered world that we will enjoy and inhabit and create with God. But it isn't there now. And so suffering is, again, in fact, inevitable. And so God then is creating a space through his grace where justice, some semblance of justice, not at the organizing level, but that will exist along with sinful humanity without obliterating one or the other. And that becomes, again, where the tension that we live in, which then, I mean, even just think of the echoes throughout the New Testament. Think of Paul writing, this present suffering will not compare to the glory that's to be revealed. Like he's saying, like there is a time in which this is all made right, all reconciled and redeemed. But we have to exist kind of in this moment with that tension.
He's not incapable, another part of that quote, he's not incapable of imposing justice on humanity, but it's love that constrains him from doing so.
Yeah.
And we don't see that any clearer than in the person of Jesus, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He could, in any moment, rule the world on a harsh rule of justice. But again, that's not the alternative that we think we want. Like, we think we want it, but when you begin to come to an understanding of how you have contributed to the tohu vavohu, then all of a sudden you're like, I actually don't want that. I wouldn't be able to stand. And so then the injustice that happens, and it's not, again, that God causes all of this pain in other people's lives, but you recognize it's the love of God that is actually allowing injustice at times so it doesn't obliterate all of humanity. So it's the love of God that constrains him from imposing a rule of justice on the world. Which then, of course, the natural question is, well, why does God not just, how does he live in that tension? But the question becomes, how does God mediate that? Because we do see moments of justice that do break through, where he does deal with some of that directly. And that, again, is where we have to lean on the wisdom of God.
Yeah.
That the wisdom of God understands from a greater vantage point that we cannot fathom, how to deliberate, where does he break in, where does he not, where does he intervene, and where does he not. And the only way we can, there's no easy answer to that other than we have to fall back again on trust on the character and the wisdom of God. And that was, you know, I think what I was trying to weave throughout was that Aslan quote of he's not safe. The lion's not safe,
yeah,
but he's good. And if we can trust in his goodness, going back to what you said earlier, Brandon, then I think we can start to at least trust his wisdom if we trust he's good.
There's a humility to be embraced in all of this, I think.
Yeah.
Like the way, and maybe it's just my own issues with pride, but I just look at this whole thing and... you know, like the simple answer, you should just trust God if you go to someone who's suffering. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. But but even God doesn't just give a simple answer that said, trust me.
Yeah.
He has to give
that's good.
Perspective.
Yeah.
To understand. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about that section where God stops, kind of like, he kind of shifts his tone, you know?
Yeah,
you said it was
a little
bit of your own conjecture, but
yeah.
He kind of shifts his tone and kind of turns into almost more of like a let me instruct and let me help you understand this a little bit more.
Yeah, one thought before we get there too is, and I mentioned this, I think second, not first, but it's important to also note that when God finally gets to these dialogues, it's after 38 chapters.
Yeah.
And so like God himself doesn't rush in and say, well, just trust me, to your point, like you were just saying. Like for him to hold off and allow in those 38 chapters for his character to be dragged through the mud, right? Like Job and all his friends and Elihu and all of them, they're tarnishing his character. And God endures that for 38 chapters before he finally speaks up. So it, all that to say, like,
he looks around heaven. He's like, all right, I'm going down.
Yeah, it's time. It's time. But there's like, he creates the space for lament. He creates the space to journey in that grief and allow it to kind of, you know, ferment, if you will, until it boils up into a different thing or a different moment. So it's important, I think, that it's 38 chapters later that God finally then addresses it. But to the earlier point, you know, the second dialogue of God, you know, I make the point that it's interesting. Job's response after the first one seems to be contrite and seems to be that he's heard the message, but God continues on. And you're like, well, that seems odd because he seems like he
gets it, God. He gets it.
Yeah, like you can back off kind of thing. But I think what God does there, and again, it is my conjecture that it feels like a shift of tone, that God is now saying, I want to maybe pull a little bit of the curtain back and allow you to see, maybe give a basis for understanding why you can trust my wisdom.
Or at least understand how much you don't know.
Yeah. And this is where it gets wild, right? This is when we meet Behemoth and Leviathan, right? These literal, what some scholars will call just chaos dragons.
Do you think Job would have known what Behemoth and Leviathan was?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And one that actually a lot of scholars wrestle with. My take on it is that they were probably some sort of creature that Job and his listeners knew little about, but had taken on sort of mythic properties.
Like a Loch Ness monster.
I was going to say like a Loch Ness monster, almost like that. Mm. Like something you've kind of heard of, but now it's taken on more meaning, like in a mythological sense. And so that's what my kind of gut tells me. Bigfoot would be another good one. Totally. Bigfoot would be another good one.
Can you imagine God being like, Bigfoot is my greatest, my greatest creation. Look at the hairy, muscles in its smelly, belly. Yeah.
Oh, but yeah. So then in that dialogue, he reveals to Job these characters, Behemoth and Leviathan, which I had never read Job. I had always imported that these must be the result of sin or brokenness or whatever it is. But again, when you read it closely, God is quite proud of Behemoth and Leviathan. And particularly with Leviathan, I mean, he's proud of it, but he clearly says, like, if you stick your hand out, you're going to experience Leviathan. You'll never forget it. Like, it's going to hurt. And I think
sinew, baby.
Yeah, hit the sinews, man. Tubes of bronze for bones. It's going to get you. But there's, you know, these creatures that exist representing that sort of disorder that are there. You'll bump into it. And every once in a while, you'll hit it, and you can't tame it. And so you can't control it as much as we try, but the flip of it is that God is very clear. It says, "But I can bring it in with a fish hook. I can put it on a leash and walk it like a dog. Like they're not rivals. They're not, you know, something that is in conflict with God. It just is. It's part of that tohu vavohu. And so there's an assurance that God is still powerful and in control, in that sense." But then there's also the fear of like when you touch it, you'll never forget it. And I think that feels like a pretty good explanation of a lot of the deep sufferings we go through. Mm. We touch Leviathan and we'll never forget it. It hurts and it's difficult. But God is still there and we trust that somehow he's making those wise decisions or that experience with Leviathan was something we can still endure as painful as it is. But it's part of that larger grace of God. He has to let some of that in order for humanity to still exist.
I have seen God work and do incredible things with suffering. And I think when I'm facing that next thing, when I run into chaos or I run into the pain or whatever, I can either forget that and be focused on myself and the pain, or I can let that remind me that God is still at work, that God is still doing stuff.
Yeah. And he may not have caused that thing. He may not have brought it about, but he's in there. And that, I mean, how beautiful that God can take all of that, knowing that brokenness is going to have to exist, that injustice is going to have to exist. He doesn't leave us there, but says, okay, if this is the case, let me then work with this for the good. Mm-hmm. Like how beautiful that he doesn't just say, well, it's got to be there and then hands off, but he's still in the midst of that working it for the good.
So I want you to leave us with, you know, this idea that we can be participating with God and his shalom and be cultivators of of the earth, or we can also, and likely will and do, participate in the chaos.
Yeah.
So you kind of left us with two different things to consider as we look at how do we respond to this. And one of them is accepting our limitations, and then to accepting the inevitability of suffering, which is a little hard as an application.
Yeah.
Like the application is like, hey,
it's going to suck. But we'll see you next week.
Yeah. It'd be almost like the dentist being like, look, what I'm about to do to you, you're going to hate me for.
Yeah.
I'm going to. Not that God always does it. You know, it's a bad illustration, but
it's not the subtitle of most sermons. You know? Just accept your limitations and you're going to suffer. But I think it is. I think if we're going to live wide-eyed to that tension of a world that doesn't run on justice, I think we're going to have to, like Job does, come to the place where he accepts his limitations. God, I had spoken of things I didn't know. I'm putting my hand over my mouth. And that isn't a defeatist, like, just never talk to God about it. It's again the acceptance that God is wiser. God has a different vantage point, one we can never grasp, and so we have to trust in God's wisdom. And then again, like, the hard part about that is not just when you accept your limitations, you quickly bump up to the realization that because I'm limited and finite, I will suffer.
Yeah.
And that will be inevitable. And so how do I just come to the place where you accept that? Again, not in a defeatist way. It isn't that God necessarily desires for you to suffer. It's just inevitable. And so we not welcome, but we understand where that comes from. And like so much in the New Testament, right? You persevere and let perseverance do its work in you. Can we allow the suffering to not focus so much on how we get around it or get over it or avoid it, but how do we get through it? And in the getting through it, we let God do his deep work within us.
I think we can we just all agree that we never want to hear God say, stand up like a man.
Yeah.
Because I'm about to.
Gird your loins, Job. It's happening.